It's good to see everybody. My family, we live full-time in the Eminence area now. Does anybody know where Eminence is? A lot of you have been there. I just want you to know, I have a lot of respect now for people who drive from Des Moines, Iowa, all the way to Eminence. It's 7.5 hours to get up here. So I respect you for doing that, and we're glad you come. Have you ever heard somebody say, Jesus will take you as you are? I hear that sometimes. And you know what? I don't have a problem with that statement, actually. That's not a wrong idea. Jesus will take you as you are, assuming we mean that in the right way. Whatever sins you have in your life, whatever baggage you bring to Him, Jesus will take you. There's nothing that you could possibly bring to Christ that is so offensive that He wouldn't take you. And that's one of the beautiful things about the Christian faith. So if we mean it in the right way, it is true, the idea that Jesus will take you as you are. However, Jesus will not leave you as you are. And this is the thought that sometimes we miss. Jesus will take us as we are, but He will not leave us as we are. The Christian life is a lifetime of change so that we can become conformed to the image of Christ. Our topic for this weekend is what I'm calling the Christian transformation. Mark asked me if I had any things that I'd be interested in speaking in, and this is one of the subjects I proposed. If you've heard me speak any time in the last 5 years, it's very possible you've heard me speak on this exact subject because I'm very passionate about it, and it's because it's something new that I have personally learned. The way that when we invest ourselves completely in the gospel, when we submit more fully to God, we become somebody different, and it's an amazing process when we let God do the work. So that's the subject for this weekend, what I'm calling the Christian transformation. But tonight's kind of a downer. It's going to take us a few sessions to get to the triumphant moment where God actually changes us. So first, let me start with this analogy. I work in healthcare. What one word in healthcare do you think scares people more than anything else? Death, that's not a bad answer. That's pretty scary. Yeah, I was thinking of cancer, so I heard several people say that. And for good reason. Cancer is a scary idea. And cancer in particular, compared to other medical conditions, it is a strange disease, isn't it? Cancer is not some foreign intruder from outside the body. Cancer is not a poison. It's not a pathogen. Where did cancer come from? It comes from you. It comes from me. Isn't that a mind-boggling idea? Anyone who develops cancer, and many, many people do in the course of their lifetime, about 40% of the average American will at some point develop some kind of cancer, or at least have a cancer diagnosed at some point in their life. And it's our own cells. Cancer is a disease when one of our own cells starts to grow and reproduce uncontrollably. It begins to invade other tissues in the body. It begins to interrupt the essential functions of the body. And then eventually, if it's left untreated, it will inevitably lead to death. I had a patient one time that I encountered that had been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And, you know, everybody responds to cancer in different ways, and understandably so. Some people, when they're diagnosed with cancer, they'd rather not be bothered by it. So they just live on with their lives, and eventually they just die because they don't do anything about the disease. Some people will follow the course of treatment recommended by their doctors. Sometimes they get better, sometimes they don't. But then there's another class of people that's very interesting. Some people, when they get diagnosed with cancer, they take it into their own hands. We had one particular individual who had an interesting approach to it. He started eating better. He started exercising. He quit drinking. He quit smoking. He started drinking highly concentrated hydrogen peroxide because he'd been told that that was a cure for cancer. He really, really tried hard to cure himself, but eventually he died. And the lesson that I observed in watching that process is that no amount of diet, exercise, and hydrogen peroxide was going to make that cancer go away. And the reason I want to use that analogy is because I do think it's helpful when we're thinking about our spiritual condition. Is there anything that you and me can do to just make our sins go away? Do we have that power in us? We don't. And so this is what we need to discuss first. So bear with me. Like I said, this first lesson's a little downer, but it needs to be, right? It needs to be in order for us to understand our incredible need for the gospel, for the saving grace of Christ. We have to understand the helplessness of the human condition. I'm not a big fan of any particular music genre. Every once in a while, though, I'll turn on the radio and see if there's something decent to listen to. And this was probably 2 or 3 years ago. I can't even quote to you all the lyrics of the song because I find it so bothersome. I change the channel as soon as I start to hear it. But the first time I listened to this particular song, I listened to it all the way through. And the theme of the song that gets repeated several times is, I believe, and then there's some statement of belief that follows after that. One of them that you might know from the song is, I believe you love who you love, ain't nothing to be ashamed of. Anybody ever heard that song before? I don't know. It's a country song. Do Iowa people listen to country songs? Okay. I don't know. I mean, Iowa's in my DNA, but I also live in South Missouri. This is the most black dirt I've seen in the last 12 years. Anyway, that's one of the lines from the song. But the line that gets repeated the most is, I believe most people are good. And that struck me. Is that actually, does the Bible teach that? Does the Bible say that most people are mostly good? It actually teaches the opposite. And this is a hard truth that we don't necessarily want to accept, but this is one of the realities of the Bible. It is not true that most people are mostly good. Most of us are overwhelmingly rotting with sin. Paul said to the Ephesians that we were just like everybody else. We were children of wrath, just as the others. We were under the authority of the prince of the power of the air. So anyway, what we need to talk about tonight is the helplessness of our condition, and we do have to accept that as human beings, we are not mostly good. We all do sin, and let's start with this question. What exactly is the problem? What is the source of our sinfulness? Why do people sin? And if you're familiar with James chapter 1, you know the answer to that question. Why is it that most people sin? Why do we sin at all? James chapter 1, verses 13 through 15, tells us exactly why we sin. Let no one say when he is tempted, I am tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he himself tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when he is drawn away by what? His own desires and enticed. Then when desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is full grown, brings forth death. This is a very interesting idea, isn't it? All of my sin and all of my temptation is ultimately rooted in my own desires. So just like cancer is not some poison or pathogen from outside of the body, temptation at its most basic cause is not exactly from outside of my body. It is from my body. These human desires are the source of every temptation that inevitably lead to sin. The Bible gives this problem a name. In the Bible, it's called the flesh. You've heard that before. You read about it quite a lot in the Bible, especially in the writings of Paul. Sometimes in some translations, it's called sinful nature. You've heard me talk about this before. I personally prefer the more literal translation, which really is the flesh, which refers to our physical bodies and the natural desires of our body. And so rather than calling the flesh the sinful nature, if we're going to call it anything else at all, I would like to call it the human nature, because that's what it is. Again, it's not some force from outside the body. It is the forces within our body. Paul described the flesh in Ephesians chapter 2, verse 3. We all once conducted ourselves in the lusts of our flesh, fulfilling the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, just as the others. When Paul adds to that, by nature, that adds some pretty significant meaning. And it is important to know what Paul means by that. Sinning is natural. It's just the naturalest thing that people do. When we sin, we are not fighting against our nature, we're collaborating with our nature. The human nature, when it's separated from God, this is an important distinction, but when the human nature is separated from God, unconditioned by God, It is an endless cycle of lust and sin. And if we're being honest with ourselves, I all think that we know this is true. I don't want a show of hands, because I think most of us would raise our hands, but how many of you could agree with me in saying that I am just now realizing how sinful I used to be? You know, we go through life not even realizing the filth that we engage in, and it's only later that we realize the sin that we had in our lives. And unfortunately, I'm afraid that 10 years from now, I'll say the same thing again. And 10 years from then, I'll say the same thing again, looking back at life, not even realizing the sin that we had been involved in. The flesh is not a thing that spontaneously created itself after Adam and Eve sinned. The reason I'm specifying that is because there's some theologies out there that basically teach that when Adam and Eve sinned, just all of a sudden the human nature completely changed and we were substantially different than how God had created us. And I don't think that's true at all. I don't believe that's what the Bible teaches. The flesh was not something that was spontaneously created after Adam and Eve sinned. Satan certainly did not create the fleshly nature that the New Testament talks about. The fleshly desires that we have that lead to sin are the same fleshly desires that God created in us in the beginning. Now, if that's the first time you've ever heard it explained that way, I can imagine that sounds a little strange. So I don't want to take a minute to defend that position. But what I just said is that the fleshly desires that we have that can eventually lead to sin are the same desires that God originally created in us. The problem is that Satan manipulates our desires to draw us into temptation and sin. But to this point about the desires that God created in us, after he created humankind, what did he say at the end of that day? It's good. Did God create anything in the beginning that was evil? No. But did Adam and Eve have the ability to sin in the beginning? They did, right? So God created something that was good, and yet at the same time, God also created humankind in a way that was still susceptible to temptation. But it's because he put desires in us that he wanted us to have that are not inherently evil. I'll give you three examples. It's perfectly natural to seek self-gratification and pleasure. Is that a sin in and of itself to desire gratification and pleasure? I mean, that's not wrong in and of itself. That desire, I would say, is just neutral at worst. It is not righteous. It is not evil to desire self-gratification or pleasure. But it is that very desire that gets manipulated by Satan and which leads to fornication, adultery, pornography, and every other sexual sin and addiction, all because of a good desire that God originally created. What about the desire to feel a sense of self-worth? Do you agree that that's natural for a person to desire some self-worth? I think so. I think that's perfectly natural, and I think that desire in and of itself, for someone to want self-worth and purpose, I think that is at worst neutral. It is not inherently righteous. It's not inherently evil. But that desire, the desire for self-worth, what are the kinds of sins that that gets turned into? Things like pride, covetousness, prejudice, bias. Those are all manifestations of our desire for self-worth and purpose. They get turned into temptation and sin. Another very straightforward example is self-preservation, the desire to be alive. That's a desire that God has created in us. I do not think that that desire is wrong in and of itself, but that desire, I can tell you as a college teacher, that is the desire that leads people to lie and cheat. The same desire that also leads to people stealing and killing, the desire for self-preservation or protection. The examples of this are endless, but just consider the first sin in the Bible. Eve sinned because of her fleshly desires. Genesis chapter 3, verse 6. So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it was pleasant to the eyes, a tree desirable to make one wise, there's the three temptations and desires, she took of its fruit and ate. So let's think about this. Eve could see that the fruit was good for food. Is that a sin to see food and think it looks good? If so, we're all in a lot of trouble because I enjoyed dinner downstairs and I think you did too. It's okay to see food and desire it because that food looks good. Because the desire to eat is natural. The Bible also says that Eve could see that the fruit looked good to the eyes. Is it a sin to appreciate natural beauty? Is that inherently wrong? No, in and of itself, it is not wrong. Eve could also see that the fruit was desirable to make her wise. So same question. Is that a sin in and of itself for a person to desire knowledge? In and of itself, that's not wrong. So I'm just pointing out that the desires that led to Eve's temptations are the same desires we have, the same desires she was created with, same desires that God gave her. And in and of themselves, they are not wrong. The problem, though, this is the problem, is when we carelessly, thoughtlessly follow the desires of the flesh, because that is not a path that leads to God. Desiring food is not a path that leads to God. Observing beauty is not the path that leads to God. Desiring earthly wisdom is not a path that leads to God. And so Paul says in Romans chapter 8, verses 7 and 8, because the carnal mind, by the way, that just means fleshly mind. It's the same word that we've been talking about. The fleshly mind is enmity against God, for it is not subject to the law of God, nor indeed can be. So then those who are in the flesh cannot please God. Our human nature and our desires get exploited by Satan and lead us to sin. So to use the cancer analogy again, which I realize this is a very personal subject, and the flesh is a very personal subject. The flesh is like that cancer. The natural desires of the flesh begin to grow uncontrollably outside of their God-given boundaries. The desires of the flesh start invading other aspects of living and thinking. The flesh then begins to interfere with the essential functions of the body and mind. And then, just like a cancer, if left untreated, the flesh leads to death. I've got a question I want you to consider. I've asked this at other church meetings before, so maybe you've heard it before, but this has me thinking about something. Every human person is living in the flesh. So this situation we're describing applies to everybody equally. So my question is, does the average person just dabble in sin, or are they drowning in sin? I don't know if I know the answer to that, but I think it's an interesting thought exercise. Still talking about the flesh, a point that we need to make about it. We've already described what it is. The flesh is, in effect, our natural human desires that just get out of control. The problem is, those fleshly desires do control us. They get out of control and begin to control us. I want to read to you a familiar passage from Romans chapter 7. I really appreciate this passage. I especially appreciated it when I was a younger man because it was like Paul was inside of my head when he was writing these words. This is Romans chapter 7, verses 14 through 19. This is the inner conflict that every person experiences as they battle with the flesh. Paul says, "For we know that the law is spiritual, but I am carnal, sold under sin. For what I am doing, I do not understand. For what I will to do, that I do not practice. But what I hate, that I do. If then I do what I will not to do, I agree with the law that it is good. But now it is no longer I who do it, but the sin that dwells in me. For I know that in me, that is in my flesh, nothing good dwells. For to will is present with me, but how to perform what is good I do not find. For the good that I will to do, I do not do, and the evil that I will not to do, that I practice." So I think everyone's probably familiar with this passage, but I'll still make a few comments on it. He is describing the battle that every human experiences with the flesh. We want to change, but we just don't. Again, I don't want a show of hands because I'm very confident all of us have had that exact experience. We have our minds made up to quit something or to start something good, and then we just don't. We have our minds made up that we want to be better, but then we aren't. We've decided that we want to conquer some sin, and then we realize that we don't know how. This is exactly what the Apostle Paul is saying. This is the way the flesh controls us. Have you ever heard the saying, if there's a will, there's a way? Everybody's heard that before. Does that agree with what Paul just said? It actually does not. What Paul just said is that to will is present with me, but how to perform what is good I do not find. This is another reality that we need to accept as human beings, and the pride in us wants to resist this. The proud part of us wants to say, no, I really can do this. I really could. I could quit this thing if I wanted to, but I just don't want to. Have you ever heard anybody say that before? I just do it because I want to. If I wanted to quit, I could. No, that's actually not true. If somebody wanted to quit something, if they're not in Christ, most likely they won't be able to. Paul is saying that you might have the will to change, but on your own, it is not possible. Why can you not do the things you want to do and make the changes you want to make? Why is it we get caught in these traps of sinning? Paul says it's because of this issue, the flesh. The natural desires of the human body are warring against our mind, against our wills. It's exactly what he says here in Galatians chapter 5, verse 17. For the flesh lusts against the spirit, and the spirit against the flesh. And these are contrary to one another, so that you do not do the things that you wish. Just on the way up here, Nate asked me a question. He was introduced to an idea for the first time, and he wanted to know if it was true or not. Sorry, you don't have to be nervous, Nate. It's okay. Somebody had introduced to him the idea of a little good angel on one side of your mind and a little bad angel on the other side of your mind. Somebody had introduced that idea to him, and he wanted to know if it was true. And I said, no, that's not exactly how this works. However, what we just read is how it works. The thing fighting against our will is our own body. Of course, Satan adds another layer of difficulty to this by enhancing our temptations, but it all starts with our own desires. So what we're fighting against is not a little demon in our mind, it's our own flesh that we battle against. It's our own human will that gets out of control. I was encouraging somebody recently who was having a hard time defeating sin, and we kind of reached to a point in the process where I just told them, listen, it's got to stop. It has to stop. And they responded, I'm trying as hard as I can, but I just can't. And I have thought about that conversation many times and tried to make some conclusions from it. And, you know, my initial response was, you don't mean that. Because most of the time when somebody says, I can't, what do they actually mean? Yeah, what they actually mean is, I'm done trying. That's what they mean by I can't. I can't usually means I've done as much as I'm willing to do. I've made as many sacrifices as I'm willing to make. I've gone as far as I'm going to go, and I am choosing not to go any farther, right? That's what I assume most people mean when they say, I can't. Sometimes when I say, I can't, that's exactly what I mean. However, I want you to consider the possibility that sometimes, and maybe a lot of times, as we're dealing with sin, that is the truth. There are some sins that we cannot and will not defeat on our own. And so maybe that person was sincere when they said, I. And see, that was where the problem was. They said, I am trying as hard as I can, and I can't. Sometimes the issue here that we're describing even stops people from becoming Christians. Have you ever heard of somebody who wanted to rid themselves of all the sins in their life before they become a Christian? What's the problem with that logic? It's not possible. It'll never happen. You cannot defeat these sins on your own. I can't. You can't. It is not possible. This is the loud message of the Bible. The Bible calls this slavery because that's exactly what it is. John chapter 8, verse 34, Jesus said to them, most assuredly, I say to you, whoever commits sin is a slave to sin. And that means everybody, because everybody sins. All of us are slaves to sin if we're not Christians. A sinner is a slave to sin. That means that sin is their master. Here's another interesting thought I want you to consider. We talk about free will, and I do think free will is real. It must be real. But within certain boundaries, because we might feel like we're free and exercising our free will. But when it comes to temptation and sin, we are actually slaves to our evil passion. And so here's the line that I like to draw. We might be free to will, but we are not free to do. Do you see how there's a difference there? Anybody is free to will to do whatever they want to do, but that doesn't mean they're actually free to do that thing. A fish is free to want to fly, but it is not free to actually fly. Similarly, a sinner is free to want to stop sinning, but according to Paul, they are not free to actually stop sinning while they are living in the flesh. Consider a very extreme example of this, a person addicted to drugs or alcohol. They, in a very visible sense, seem to be controlled by their sinful desires. It's the same sinful desires that everybody has. It's just manifested usually in a more obvious way. They're controlled by their sinful desires. They are slaves to their sin and their addiction. And what I mean by that is they couldn't stop even if they wanted to in many cases. One time when I was a brand new x-ray tech working in our local emergency department, I was called out to do a portable chest x-ray on an alcoholic that had been pulled in off the street. And if you don't know this, that's extremely common. I did lots and lots of x-rays and CAT scans on people who were sloppy drunk. Somebody found them on the side of the road. They didn't know what to do. They just called 911 and they get brought to the hospital and their health gets checked out. That is extremely common. And anyway, this was my first exposure to that. I had very little exposure to people with addictions like this. So I went into the room to do the chest x-ray, and I really shouldn't have done this, but it did make for a good lesson that worked well in the sermon right now. I asked the alcoholic, I said, "Why do you keep doing this to yourself?" And he gave me an honest answer, I think. He said, "I can't help myself. I'm an alcoholic." And there is a level of truth to that. Every person living outside of Christ is a slave to sin. Not just alcoholics, but every single one of us. As we live in sin, we willingly make sin our master. And so in the flesh, failure is inevitable. If it feels like a hopeless situation, it's because it is a hopeless situation. If it's not a hopeless situation, why was it necessary for the Son of God to come in the flesh and die on the cross for our sins? Right? That's why the gospel is necessary. And that's why we had to start on this note, realizing the seriousness of our situation. The Bible describes sin as not just a thing you do. I'm calling this section of the lesson the rule of sin. Let me tell you what I mean by that. The language of the Bible is very intentional in how it describes the power of sin over humankind. Sin is described as our master that rules over us in the flesh. This is Romans chapter 6, verse 12. "Therefore, do not let sin reign in your mortal bodies, that you should obey its lust." And so sin in the flesh is like a king. It's our master. Sin in the Bible is also described as a disease. It's like an infection. Romans chapter 5, verse 12. "Therefore, just as through one man, sin entered the world," not sinning, but sin entered the world, "and death through sin, and thus death spread to all men because all sinned." The way this is worded here, again, it's like sin is a disease, and sin has to have a host, and who becomes the host of sin? We do. We become the host. And so sin spreads from person to person to person and even within the person, so that we become overwhelmed by sin. Eventually, if it's left unchecked outside of Christ, every area of our life becomes ate up with sin. Like I said, I feel like this language is extremely intentional because it's a metaphor of the reality of the way the flesh and sin controls us. Here's one way of looking at this. The language here tells us that an unconverted person is in sin all of the time, even when they are not actively sinning. I'll say that again and I need to explain it. An unconverted person is in sin all of the time, even when they are not actively sinning. Because sin is not just the thing that you do. The Bible also describes it as a way of thinking, a way of living. This is the idea of Titus chapter 1, verses 15 and 16. Paul says, this is Titus 1, verses 15 and 16. Paul says, to the pure, all things are pure. But to those who are defiled and unbelieving, nothing is pure. Even their mind and conscience are defiled. They profess to know God, but in their works they deny him, being abominable, disobedient, and disqualified for every good work. I'll give you an analogy here. Some of you know that about 10 years ago, my wife had some extremely serious health concerns, and she's doing much better now, but it was a long road, and there's still ups and downs. My wife has a condition that's called ulcerative colitis. There's multiple forms of colitis. There's infectious colitis. There's ischemic colitis. But ulcerative colitis, I find to be the most bothersome because it's an autoimmune condition, which pretty much means nobody knows exactly what causes it. And you can treat the symptoms, but there's no way of curing it. And so for my wife with this ulcerative colitis, she doesn't even have a colon anymore, by the way. But even without her colon, the flares of manifest illness come and go, but the disease is always there. It's a baffling thing. A person with ulcerative colitis, even without a colon, still has ulcerative colitis. Even when she feels well, the disease still exists in her body. And the reason I'm using that analogy is because this is exactly how sin is. The unconverted sinner is always in sin, always controlled by sin, even when they're not actually sinning. The flares of sinning come and go, but the disease is always there, always controlling. Even when their behavior is good, the disease is still at work in their mind and body. And by the way, I asked Joanna if it was okay if I compared her to an unregenerate sinner, and she said it was fine. So all of this leads to what I think is another interesting question. By the way, I never really saw an end time for tonight. Does anybody have a proposal on when we stop? Mark says keep going. So, okay, fair enough. Yeah. And there's a glare on the clock, so honestly, I don't even know what time it is anyway, so we'll just roll along. I do have a few more points that we'll make. So we've talked about the severity of the human condition, the power of the flesh, that we're living as slaves to the flesh. When you describe it that way, it does lead to a very interesting question. How does a person ever not sin? Given the fact that we're controlled by the flesh while we're outside of Christ, how do we ever not sin? Given the condition of the human nature, how do we ever make a righteous decision? And I've had this particular debate with different people. Again, a theology you run into every once in a while is that outside of Christ, you don't make righteous decisions. There's some people who teach the idea of total depravity. Has anybody ever heard of that before? Total depravity. It's the idea that every human being is born with a totally rotten mind, totally overwhelmed by the flesh, without even having the desire to serve God or seek God. And I find that is totally out of line with the Bible. But everything I've said so far still begs that question. How do we ever make righteous decisions? And there's an answer to that. The answer is that the fleshly nature is not the only force at work in the human mind. God gave us the flesh, but what else did he give us? He also gave us the mind. He gave us a soul, and he gave us the conscience, a natural God-given sense of right and wrong, a God-given sense of morality, and a God-given sense of eternity. Of course, you know that Romans, the first couple chapters, talked about this. I'll give you one verse from Romans chapter 2, verses 14 and 15. Gentiles who do not have the law, by nature do the things in the law. Well, how is that possible? Well, he says, by nature. It is natural to sin, but it's also natural to observe the things that were in the Jewish law. And so Paul says, these, although not having the law, are a law to themselves, who show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness. So the conscience is just the law of God that's written on the human heart. Conscience is what compels us to do what's right, to avoid what's wrong. The conscience is the part that God gave us in our minds that sees God, that desires God, that even knows God intuitively. These righteous desires of the conscience are at war with the unrighteous desires of the flesh. It's the conscience that wills to do good, the flesh that wills to do evil. The conscience wills to satisfy God. What does the flesh will to satisfy? Self. And that's the problem. The flesh is inherently selfish. There's a familiar story that demonstrates the conflict between the will of the flesh and the will of the mind. You remember what Jesus said to his friends when he found them sleeping after he'd been praying in the garden? He says, "Watch and pray lest you enter into temptation, because the spirit indeed is what? Willing, but the flesh is weak." That represents the battle that every human person must realize. The conscience says, stay awake. The flesh says, go to sleep. The conscience says to trust in the Lord. The flesh says to be afraid. The conscience says to stand for what's right, and the flesh says to run. And so Paul concludes in Romans chapter 7, verse 25, "So then with the mind I myself serve the law of God, but with the flesh the law of sin." So we do have this great advantage that God does give us the conscience. But here's the problem. The flesh almost always wins. The will of the flesh is stronger than the will of the conscience. The human will is not strong enough to defeat consistently over the course of a lifetime to defeat the desires of the flesh. Romans chapter 7, verses 22 through 24, "For I delight in the law of God according to the inward man." So there is this part of me, inside of me, that desires the laws of God. But he says in verse 23, "I see another law in my members," which I think is the flesh, "warring against the law of my mind, bringing me into captivity to the law of sin, which is in my members. O wretched man that I am, who will deliver me from this body of death?" So Paul is saying the desires of the flesh are too powerful for the natural man to escape. The flesh eventually wins. And again, I told you tonight's a little bit of a downer. To add to this problem is eventually the conscience just dies. That is what the Bible teaches. As the conscience loses battle after battle after battle over the course of a lifetime, and to an extent over the course of generations, the conscience of individual people and groups of people eventually just dies. The conscience can get to a point where it no longer has any meaningful influence over our decision making. I definitely don't want a show of hands here, but maybe you know people like this, unfortunately, who seem to have reached this point in their life where they just have no desire to do what's right. They have no sense of right and wrong. Their conscience seems to be completely dead. As I understand the Bible, every person is born with a healthy conscience, implanted by God, designed by God, but God actually lets the conscience die because of our resistance to him. If you go over to Romans chapter 1, Paul spells out how this happened collectively to the Gentiles. Paul has explained that the Gentiles do know about God, that the Gentiles do have a conscience, but that conscience is dying. Romans chapter 1, verse 21, Paul says, "Although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts." Same idea in Romans chapter 1, verse 24. "Therefore God also gave them up to uncleanness." Romans chapter 1, verse 26. "God gave them up to vile passions." Romans chapter 1, verse 28. Listen to this one. "Even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a debased mind." So what Paul is saying is happening is once our conscience gets to a point that we're not interested in even knowing God, God releases us to our own devices. So the flesh is powerful. We do have the conscience, but what the Bible teaches is the conscience gets destroyed over time. And then we've got another layer to this. One more thing. God gave us the conscience. God also gave us the law. He gave the Jews an actual written code. I'll give you an analogy here that will show you the limitation, though, of having a law. I don't know all the laws here in Iowa, but I'm guessing it's the same in Missouri. Do having laws in Iowa make people follow the rules? Okay, I was just checking to make sure, because that's exactly how it works in Missouri as well. In fact, where we're from is kind of bush country. A lot of people are perfectly happy to be totally ignorant of the laws. But just to give you an analogy of the limitation of having law, God has told us exactly what he wants. Let me give you an analogy here. For about 10 years, I taught at a little private school where we trained students to be radiographers and other medical imaging technologists. And we have lots of rules. I think probably every school has lots of rules. But because we're teaching people healthcare professions, which sort of has its own body of rules, we have gobs and gobs of rules. We have a rule book and books about rules. But you know what happens every year? We have many students who basically follow all the rules. They check all the boxes. They follow the rules. They pass all their classes. But does that guarantee they will leave our program as good students? It actually does not. They still sometimes come out not having the knowledge that they need to pass their certification exams and still don't have the skills that they need to become a competent technologist. So how is that possible? I mean, we have hundreds of pages of rules. You would think those rules would do the job, but that's not how rules work. Can rules in and of themselves change a person's motivation? Not necessarily. Can rules make you learn? Not necessarily. I mean, I wish they could. As a teacher for 10 years, I've been trying to find rules that would make students learn. But it doesn't always work that way. Can rules in and of themselves make somebody a sincere and hard worker? Is that how it works? That's not how it works. Rules cannot make you a good person. Rules cannot make you a good employee. And in the example I was using, rules cannot make a person pass a certification exam. And this exact principle is true in our relationship with God. This is one of the realities of the Christian faith that I struggled with for so long, and I'm just now getting my mind wrapped around it. And unfortunately, as we finish tonight, I'm going to leave you with more questions, and I won't answer them until tomorrow. But one of the things we learn in the Bible that God proved to us through the Mosaic Law is that codes of moral law cannot change a person's motivation. It cannot make a person righteous, and rules in and of themselves cannot stop a person from sinning. So my point is that law by itself does not have the power to change a person. I'll give you one scripture on this. This is one of my favorite scriptures on this point because I think this is a beautiful description of what I have found to be reality. The Colossians, like some other Gentile believers, started dabbling in the Mosaic Law. They thought the Mosaic Law was interesting. They thought that it would be good to start incorporating elements of the Mosaic Law into the Christian faith. And what Paul's going to say here is that is completely useless to you. That is not going to help you. Colossians chapter 2, I'll read this, verses 20 through 23. Therefore, if you died with Christ from the basic principles of the world, why, as though living in the world, do you subject yourselves to regulations? He's saying, why do you subject yourself to even more rules? And he goes on in verse 21, do not touch, do not taste, do not handle, which all concern things which perish with the using, according to the commandments and doctrines of men. These things, here's what he says, indeed have an appearance of wisdom in self-imposed religion, false humility, and neglect of the body, but are of no value against the indulgence of the flesh. This is why, for example, that diets don't work. If you've ever been on any kind of diet, diets pretty much boil down to rules, right? There's two rules for pretty much every diet. Stop eating the bad stuff and stop eating so much of the good stuff. Isn't that pretty much what every diet is? And that is exactly why diets don't work. Because generally, they're just rules. Some people are very disciplined and good at following those rules, but most people, like myself, are not good at following those rules. Because just somebody telling me to stop eating the bad stuff does not change that I like eating the bad stuff. Somebody telling me to stop eating so much of the good stuff doesn't change that I want to, right? That's the problem with rules. They do not change a person's nature. And eventually we'll get to this very point tomorrow. The only way to escape the cycle of sin is not to implement more rules, but to experience a fundamental change in our nature. One last point that I'll make as we close. When we try to live just by following the rules, I'm not saying stop following the rules, just so you know, I guess this maybe could be confusing. I'm not saying it's useless following the rules. Obviously, God expects us to follow the rules. But if that is our measure of righteousness, and then if that is the way we believe that we will be righteous, that's a real problem, because the Bible teaches that actually makes the problem worse. Trying to live by a moral code as if that in and of itself is the path to righteousness makes the problem worse, because prohibition creates interest, and interest creates desire. You remember how Paul said in Romans 5, verse 7, "For when we were in the flesh, the sinful passions which were aroused by the law were at work in our members to bear fruit to the body." I think everybody can relate to this a little bit. You can't desire something if you don't know it exists, right? As soon as somebody tells you not to do something, you start wondering why not. For example, Nate and I like to go hunting on a cattle farm, not for cows, but for deer. I just feel like I should clarify that. The way it's written in my notes, it sounds like we're out hunting cows. That'd be a lot easier, just so you know. But anyway, we like to go hunting out on a cattle farm that has a lot of electric fences on it. And Nate had never been introduced to an electric fence, so I told him, everybody knows where this is going, I told him about the electric fence. If I'd never mentioned the electric fence, it probably wouldn't have been a problem. I mean, it might have been a problem, but maybe not. But when I told him about the electric fence, it definitely became a problem. He immediately wanted to know what it was like to touch the electric fence. He wanted to know every detail of every physical reaction that he might experience if he touched that fence. So we were wandering around this farm, and I got tired of the questions. So like any good dad, I said, just touch the fence. So he touched the fence. Now he knows why. But you know what's baffling? He's still interested in touching electric fences. He wants to know if this one will hurt as bad as the last one. Every time my wife makes basket dinner, I have the exact problem. She makes this delicious dessert, puts it away, and tells me about it because I need to know not to eat it. But that's the problem. Now I know. If the dessert was just, you know, invisible to me, it would be fine. And this is what the Bible is talking about. The law is not bad. It's good when my wife tells me to stay out of the dessert. It's good that I told Nate to stay away from the electric fence. The problem is those rules in and of themselves do not change our desires. And that's what we'll need to begin talking about tomorrow. The only way to change is to be changed. Do we have in and of ourselves the ability, the power to change the nature of our flesh? Can we do that? We don't. And that's when we can accept that we are utterly dependent on the grace of God to be changed. Not just to change, but to be changed. And that's what we'll talk about tomorrow. Thanks for your time and attention tonight. We'll close the lesson there and offer an invitation to anybody who's not obeyed the gospel. If you understand the helplessness of the human condition, that's the first step in understanding your need for the gospel. If you'd like to obey the gospel tonight, we can do that as we stand and sing.